I'm Dr. Emily Silverman, and welcome to Talking Dementia with Remo Health. Join us as we explore the latest advances, insights, and strategies that help empower those living with dementia and the families that support them. Each episode, we sit down with leading experts, from physicians and researchers to policymakers and clinicians, to provide you with the resources needed to navigate this complex disease. Today, we're speaking with Dr. Kate Posine. Kate is a neuropsychologist and professor in the Department of Neurology at UCSF. Her research focuses on enhancing detection, diagnosis, and care for neurodegenerative diseases like Alzheimer's or Lewy body disease. She leads the TabCat project, a platform for cognitive testing, and developed the Brain Health Assessment for quick cognitive impairment screening. She also directs the Care Ecosystem, a support program for dementia patients and caregivers. Kate, thank you so much for being here today.
It's great to be here, Emily. Thanks for having me.
So, Kate, you're a neuropsychologist. What is a neuropsychologist, and how is it different from a neurologist?
A neuropsychologist thinks about the relationship between the brain and behavior or cognition. So, for example, what parts of the brain are important for different cognitive skills or behavior? And we have tests that we use to try to tease apart which cognitive skills are working well and where there are relative weaknesses. And we can use that for diagnosis. A neurologist uses other tools to try to understand how the brain is working. And in the best clinics, we see neurologists and neuropsychologists working together in a complementary way. So a neurologist is probably going to spend more time looking at the medical history and comorbidities. They're going to think about the movement usually a little bit more, like a motor exam and watching if patients can walk, for example, in a normal way. They might incorporate some biomarker testing. And so when you see a neurologist and a neuropsychologist working in the same clinic, the neuropsychologist's exam is one piece of information, an important piece that the neurologist uses to help arrive at a diagnosis and also to monitor how a patient is doing over time.
So you mentioned that neuropsychologists can do tests to understand which parts of the brain or areas of the brain or functions of the brain are being affected by the disease. And my understanding is the way that you do those tests are these different cognitive assessments. So they're almost like quizzes or games that test different functions of the brain. And there's a lot of different types of cognitive assessments. There's the MoCA, there's the Mini-Mental, and there's another one that you developed called TabCat. Can you tell us a little bit about these different assessments, and if someone's about to get one, what might they expect and what are these tests really doing?
When somebody has concerns for cognitive change or memory change, the first thing to do is to talk to your primary care provider and ask for a brain health assessment. Ask for that doctor to either give you an evaluation for brain health changes or to refer you to a specialist who can do that. Most primary care providers do feel comfortable doing some brief cognitive assessments in their office. The primary care provider might do it, or they might have someone else on their team do the testing. And these tests tend to be very brief. They don't really tell you what parts of the brain are working and what aren't working, but they do tell you how are you performing compared to how we would expect. So like on the Mini-Mental exam that you mentioned, this is one of the most common tests. You're being asked to remember some words and copy a picture. You might be asked what the date is and so on. So you're asked all these different questions and then you get a score from 0 to 30. If that score is not close to 30, maybe it's 24 or 20, that's when the doctor starts to worry that maybe there really is some cognitive impairment going on. And then the primary care provider might provide a diagnosis and connect you to care, or might refer you to a specialist like a neurologist or a geriatrician to do a more detailed evaluation.
What about the TABCAT assessment that you developed? It sounds like there was a gap that needed to be filled. So tell us about that.
Yes, I am very driven by gaps in care. And one of the big gaps that I'm working on is that most people with neurodegenerative diseases are diagnosed too late. Typically, a person with Alzheimer's is diagnosed in the moderate stage of dementia, by which point it's so obvious that the person has dementia. Frankly, it's almost an afterthought to do that diagnosis. The person is already not able to function in their everyday life. This is too late to benefit from treatments. So we need to diagnose people earlier. We need to diagnose them during what we call the mild cognitive impairment stage. This is the stage where the person has started to experience some change in their memory or other thinking skills, but it's not bad enough that it's interfering with their everyday functions. They're still able to drive and grocery shop, prepare a meal, engage in their hobbies, but they notice that they're maybe not remembering things as well. So we want to diagnose people at this early stage. And this is so important because then we can connect them to better care and treatments and allow that family a chance to plan ahead for how to manage the disease. So that's the gap in care that we try to address with TABCAT, which is a computerized cognitive assessment that fits in nicely to primary care workflows. So a primary care provider can do this test with you if you have a concern for your memory. And then everything is scored automatically, and the results are instantly available for the primary care provider in the electronic health record. This makes it a lot easier for the primary care provider, and also the tests are more sensitive to the early stages. So we're really trying to move towards earlier diagnosis for patients and families when there's a concern for changes in thinking skills.
You focused on the importance of early detection. Is TABCAT able to pick up more subtle deficits in memory and other functions compared to the MoCA and the Mini-Mental? Is it like a finer tool to catch things earlier?
That's right. So it's more accurate at detecting mild cognitive impairment. In other words, what the TABCAT test says that a person is impaired, it's more likely to be true. And when the TABCAT says you're not impaired, that's also more likely to be true. So it's more accurate. And then also, it's easier to fit into workflows. And we can't underestimate the importance of that because primary care providers are so busy taking care of many problems for each patient. So we need to think of ways to make it easier for primary care providers to do their work well. And TABCAT is easier because with the traditional assessments, the primary care provider has to spend 20 minutes administering a test, and then they don't even have time to score it or give back feedback. Whereas with TABCAT, the medical assistant can run the test with the patient. It's much easier. It's just on an iPad, and it's practically self-administered. And then the results are scored in a more sophisticated way, can be instantly available. So I'd say those are the two advantages. It's more accurate and the workflow is easier.
And the MoCA, the Mini-Mental, and the TABCAT, you said, are shorter tests that can be given in a primary care doctor's office. There are also neuropsychological tests that are much longer, sitting down with somebody for an hour, even 2 hours to do more extensive testing. What's the difference between the short tests and the long tests? Is the long test just a deeper look into brain function?
When you do the deeper test with a neuropsychologist, then you start to be able to put together a pattern of which cognitive skills are working well and where there are problems. The neuropsychologist uses that pattern to then make inferences about which parts of the brain are working well and which aren't. And why is that important? Knowing which parts of the brain are not working well gives us clues about what the cause is. And ultimately, to really make an impact with treatment, we want to know what the cause of that cognitive impairment is. For example, is it Alzheimer's disease? Is it Lewy body dementia? Is it frontotemporal dementia? Is it vascular-related cognitive impairment? Those would be the most common, and then there are some less common causes as well. So that's one of the reasons why we'd use a neuropsychologist. But also, the neuropsychologist can think about, based on this pattern of strengths and weaknesses, here's what we might expect for the person's functioning in everyday life, and here's how they might be able to compensate. For example, let's say I have somebody whose memory is quite poor, but their planning and reasoning skills are intact. That type of person might be able to take good advantage of strategies to support their memory, like instituting a calendar or reminder system to help compensate for their memory. So that's another role of neuropsychologists, is to try to think about, given this pattern of strengths and weaknesses, how can we help this person function as well as possible in their everyday life? All that said, the vast majority of people who are being evaluated for dementia never see a neuropsychologist.
What are some of the domains that the testing looks at? You mentioned short-term memory, long-term memory. I know there's visual processing, spatial processing. There's also planning and executive function. Can you give us a tour of which parts of the brain function the tests are usually looking at?
There's a lot of different ways that you could bin cognitive functions. I usually like to bin them in five major buckets. So we have memory, executive functions, which would include attention, visual spatial skills, language and speech, and then also behavior. People often forget behavior, but your brain controls your behavior and personality. Sometimes brain diseases will actually target the parts of the brain that control our behavior and personality. So it's important to assess that too. So those are the five major buckets, but even within those, there's a lot of nuance. For example, there's different types of memory that are supported by different parts of the brain. But that's generally how I like to organize my thinking around cognitive domains.
You said that even though neuropsychological testing is incredibly helpful in diagnosing the disease that's affecting the brain and also monitoring people's brain function as it evolves over time, that a lot of people never see a neuropsychologist and never get neuropsych testing. Tell us about why that is. Is it an access issue? Is it an awareness issue? Is it supply, demand? Why is there this gap?
Most people with dementia are diagnosed by their primary care provider, and that's actually also where they receive most of their care for dementia. So living here in San Francisco, there are a lot of neuropsychologists and neurologists, and there is access to specialist care. And then there's other parts of this country where there are very few neurologists or neuropsychologists available for the population, and it's just simply not available. However, even in cities, even in San Francisco, we see access issues. So you see real socioeconomic disparities in who goes to see a dementia specialist, a neuropsychologist or a neurologist. And I think that we have a responsibility actually as dementia specialists to reach out and to make sure that all people know about our services and why it's important to get a diagnosis and to try to understand those barriers to access and to help address them. But I think it's a complex problem that we need to address. And I've seen improvement over time during the course of my career. When I first started working in this space, when I first graduated with my training, I found that in dementia specialty centers, it was almost exclusively very highly educated, mostly white people who are coming in to see our services. And we're starting to see more diversity in the access, which is improving. But still, there are major inequities in access to dementia specialist care, including neuropsychologists. So I think it's a complex problem that you bring up. That said, I think there are ways to give patients good care without always seeing a specialist. I think we need to face the reality that there isn't capacity for all people who are dealing with dementia to see a neurologist or a neuropsychologist. And I think there's other models of care that we can use. where we can provide good care in collaboration with primary care, with nurse support, navigator support, that can provide good outcomes for patients and families, even though not everyone is going to see a specialist.
That's probably a good transition to the care ecosystem. Tell us about care ecosystem. What is it and why is that model so important?
When I started working at the Memory and Aging Center, I was impressed by the high quality of care that was provided by our neurologists and the other members of our multidisciplinary team. We had pharmacy, nursing, psychologists, social work. It was an incredible experience for me to see the quality of care that was provided. But I was very concerned, too, that most people with dementia were not finding their way to receive this type of care. So we wanted to develop a model of dementia care that was scalable. In other words, a type of care that could really be available to all people struggling with these disease. So it needed to be cost efficient, but still capture the most important aspects of dementia care. So the care ecosystem is a telephone-based care navigation program. People with dementia and their caregivers are connected with a care navigator. This is a dementia care guide who is their partner as they face the challenges of dementia care. Now, that care navigator is not licensed, but they are well supported by dementia specialists with experience and expertise in nursing, social work, and pharmacy. So when a problem exceeds the scope of the navigator's role, they can connect in the dementia specialist. The care navigator has a caseload and stays with that caseload as they navigate the disease. So their relationship is really built between that care navigator and the family. So in this way, we're providing that relationship, that support, that guidance to families. And we're also giving them access to dementia specialist expertise when it's needed, because when there's a question about a medication, that pharmacist can be looped in to answer, for example.
And is this a model that was found to previously work in cancer care? Are we translating the model from cancer to dementia? Are there similarities, differences between cancer and dementia?
The cancer field is ahead of the dementia field in many ways. And indeed, they have had great success with care navigation. It's been shown to improve outcomes in cancer care. So yes, we have learned a lot from the cancer field. Of course, there are differences as well. I think one of the big differences in dementia care is that we work directly with the caregiver most of the time. The caregiver is making decisions on behalf of the patient, and we're also trying to support that caregiver to help alleviate their feelings of burden and depression that are so common. Also, dementia is always a progressive disease, and so the challenges evolve over time and affect the person's level of function. So there's certainly some really important differences between cancer care and dementia care, but this concept of care navigation and nurse-led teams has been shown to be important for both cancer and dementia.
You've done some really great work looking at underdiagnosis and misdiagnosis in people who have Medicare. And I was wondering if you could speak to, again, some of these gaps, people who maybe don't have access and that might be why they're not getting diagnosed. Do we try to bring the whole system to them with all of these different care providers, or do we take a more realistic approach where we have the phone-based navigation system and really try to operate within primary care? How do we close some of these gaps? Tell us how we address these issues of underdiagnosis and misdiagnosis.
For the problem of underdiagnosis, primary care needs to be a key partner. They're usually the first person to hear about memory problems. Currently, too often, primary care providers will dismiss the problem, or perhaps there are other issues the patient is bringing up that feel more urgent to address. And so typically, the memory concerns that might have been brought up or endorsed are not fully addressed until they become worse. So we need to support primary care providers to do a workup for detection that's feasible, easy to do, and accurate. But importantly, what I've found with primary care, they're most motivated to pay attention to a problem if they can link diagnosis to care for the patient, to better outcomes, if there's something they can do about it. And one of the reasons primary care hasn't been that motivated to pay attention to brain health is because of this feeling that, well, there's nothing I can really do about it. So we need to make sure there is something that can be done. I would like to see large health systems like UCSF, for example, to have a dementia center that primary care providers can refer patients to. So after they detect that a patient has MCI or dementia, they can connect that patient into the dementia center. Just like UCSF and most academic institutions or the health systems, they have a cancer center. We need a dementia center where patients get a care navigator and can be connected into whatever type of care they need at that time. Do they need a more comprehensive diagnostic evaluation? Are they a good candidate for one of the disease-modifying therapies for Alzheimer's disease? Do they need palliative care support? There's different types of care that are available in these large health systems like UCSF, but they're operating in silos, and families don't know where to go to receive that care. And primary care providers don't always know where to refer patients to get that care, and it's one of the reasons they're not bothering to diagnose. So these problems, these two big gaps that I've been working on the most, which are underdiagnosis or late diagnosis, and then inadequate care for families after they're diagnosed, these problems are linked. We need to have better care for families, and this will encourage primary care providers to focus more on detection and diagnosis. And we need to set up good systems for accomplishing both tasks.
I know REMO and other health systems have been looking very seriously at telemedicine and virtual appointments as a way to increase access. For example, if you're a patient or a family and you live in a rural area and there isn't an academic medical center close by or there isn't a dementia center close by, we can use technology to bring the care to them in the form of telemedicine, for example. What are your thoughts on telemedicine and virtual care as it pertains to dementia?
I think it's a great solution. Caregivers like virtual care. They're busy. Caregivers are busy, and we need to support them. And they also need help when they need help. When the person with dementia is exhibiting a new symptom like wandering, and they're trying to figure out how to stop their spouse from wandering out of the house, which is unsafe, they need to be able to get support for that quickly and not make an appointment for 2 weeks from now or 2 months from now, and maybe you have to drive an hour even to get to that appointment. So we need to support caregivers better than that. And they actually prefer telemedicine. And the types of support that they need when it comes to dementia care can be delivered over the phone or video conference.
Tell us about GUIDE. What is GUIDE and why is it important?
So GUIDE is a service and payment model that has been recently released by Medicare for people with fee-for-service Medicare. And it is a huge step forward for Medicare. It is the first payment model they've ever had that really thinks about caregivers. And I think this is so important in dementia. You have to think about the caregivers. So what is it? So the type of care that we've shown to work with the care ecosystem, and there's other groups who have similar models out there like the care ecosystem, this comprehensive care that's team-based, that supports patients and families, provides care navigation, this type of care that care ecosystem is an example of, it works. It improves quality of life for people with dementia, it improves well-being for caregivers, and it has other great outcomes too, like reducing emergency room visits, reducing dangerous medication use like antipsychotics and dementia. So these models of care, like the care ecosystem, have been shown to have benefits. In fact, Medicare funded a lot of the research that led to these conclusions. Medicare has been very interested in finding better solutions for dementia care. So because of this evidence from the research on the care ecosystem and on similar models, Medicare developed this payment model, which is a way of paying health systems and other providers to deliver the care. They announced that they were going to do this new payment model following an executive order from the Biden administration. Then they invited health systems and other providers to apply to be providers. And they selected approximately 390 of these organizations to be guide providers. And REMO is one of them. UCSF is one of them. Then the organizations were able to start delivering care starting in July of 2024. So this program of guide will go for 8 years, and Medicare has hired some groups to evaluate if it works, that we're able to show that guide does improve outcomes for patients and families, as these care models have done in prior research, because we want Medicare to expand this benefit and to make it permanent.
And why does it feel so innovative for the government to pay for interdisciplinary care, or care that involves not just a doctor, but a doctor and a nurse and a social worker and a neuropsychologist? Why do we need a whole executive order to get the government to pay these teams? Is it something about the old model that was still stuck in this mindset of one doctor, one patient, less focused on a team model? Or what had to change in order for this payment to make sense?
Medicare payment models have always been, until now, patient-centric. So yes, especially in fee-for-service Medicare, which is about half of Medicare, Medicare is reimbursing for encounters between a qualified provider, which is usually a doctor or a nurse, depending on the service, and that patient. But the research on the care ecosystem and other similar models has shown that it's really this team-based care, and also that there's an important role for a care navigator who might not be licensed as a medical provider to improve outcomes. And that providing this team-based care not only improves outcomes for families, it also saves Medicare money, which turns out is really important. When I started working on the care ecosystem 10 years ago, I didn't know what the difference between Medicare and Medicaid were. In fact, I didn't know much about economics at all. But it turns out that economics is really important when you're trying to make change in healthcare. And these types of care programs, like the care ecosystem, can actually save Medicare money, because by providing supportive, proactive care to families, we keep patients out of the hospital and out of the emergency room. So this is one of the big motivators that for Medicare to be able to embrace this type of program. They anticipate that it's not going to cost them more money in the long run. They'll have to invest money up front, but that they'll have downstream savings because people with dementia will use emergency-related care less often.
Dementia is a huge looming issue with our aging population, and that a huge amount of healthcare spending in this country comes from older people, end-of-life care, like in that last year or two of life is where a lot of the spending happens. With care ecosystem is the idea that we keep people out of the emergency room, we keep people out of the hospital, we keep people from cycling in and out of the hospital with confusion or infections. Is the goal to keep people at home?
That's often the goal. But ultimately, whether someone should stay at home or whether someone should, say, move into a facility where there's more support, is a complicated and very personal decision for every family. But what we do want is that patients and families know what to expect as much as possible, that they are prepared for that, the things that we know are going to happen, so that they're not in a crisis situation. They have a plan in place for if something goes wrong or changes, so that the first response is not always go to the emergency room. Unfortunately, when people with dementia go to the emergency room, it often leads to a hospitalization, and that's not always a good thing. It's often not a good thing for the person with dementia. It can be very disorienting to be in the hospital when you have dementia. You have people interrupting your sleep. You're in a new environment. You might be put on new medications. This can lead to confusion and delirium, when oftentimes that person with dementia might have been better off at home if there had been a plan in place. So we try to shift from a crisis-oriented mode of care to one that is more continuous and proactive, planful, supported as much as possible. Does this mean delaying time till someone's placed or maybe not getting placed at all? That's really varies depending on the family and their needs. Sometimes it's the best decision for the family, for the person with dementia, to move to a facility. And other times, care in the home is the best solution. It's very personal to each family situation.
So based on all of your experience and all of your research, what do you think is the blue sky for dementia care in the future? What would you most like to see happen in the next 5, 10, 20 years?
I would like to see in the next 2 or 3 years. So I would like families to be aware that brain health is a problem to talk about with their doctors. I would like primary care providers to ask routinely about changes in brain health. And when they have a concern or they hear about a concern from the family, to act on it, to provide an evaluation for that family, and then to connect that family with care. I would like for there to be a place for each primary care provider to refer a newly diagnosed patient to. So at a large health system, that should be one organizing dementia care center. Also, organizations like REMO and other companies that have been stepping in to fill some of these gaps. But each primary care provider should be able to have somewhere they can refer the patient and their family following diagnosis to help them to get educated about what's going on and to put an initial plan in place and get connected to the best resources that are available to them. And also, I would like for patients who are good candidates for treatment to be connected to that treatment early so that they can take advantage of that. We now have some treatments that can slow Alzheimer's disease for some patients if the patients are diagnosed early enough. And we're going to see more treatments coming soon that will likely be more effective. So we need to start to get these systems in place so that patients can take advantage of these exciting breakthroughs.
Well, I think that's a good note to end on. I want to say thank you to you, Kate, for speaking with us here at REMO about your amazing work and breaking down some of these ideas and concepts. It does seem like the future is bright. And if this pilot program with GUIDE and the 8-year trial goes well, hopefully, like you said, it expands and becomes permanent, and then we can have a lot of resources to play with to realize some of your vision. So thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for listening. For more information about this episode, check out the links and resources listed in the show notes. If you're interested in learning more from REMO, visit us at www.remo.health. Take care.